You're listening to CITR's UBC 100 Doc Series. We are broadcasting from the ancestral, unceded territory of the Hukkaminam-speaking Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. In the last year, CITR has been digitizing our collection of reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes containing an archive of audio broadcast on UBC's campus and community radio station from 1949 to the late 90s. With help from the UBC University Archives and the UBC Library Digitization Center, 400 audio files are now available for the public to listen and download, with more on the way. To share this history, we have made a series of documentaries produced by students and community broadcasters. This project is funded by UBC's Centennial Initiative Fund, celebrating a century of success at UBC. Tune in every Thursday at 4 p.m. for the next 4 weeks from January 14th to February 4th for a new documentary. And visit our website, citr.ca/docs, for podcasts, interviews with the producers, and more information.
I distinctly remember hearing my brother play the Young Canadian song Hawaii. It was 1985 and I was in grade 7. Things were never really the same for me after that. Soon I was buying records off a local metalhead named Tim. He would ensure me what was good, and my own collection quickly grew to include Void, Rudimentary Peni, Crucifix, and many other extreme bands. Over the next few years, I was also listening to CITR Friday nights to hear about experimental music and local punk gigs. When I could, the few punks in my town and I would travel to legendary places like Viking Hall in Surrey, BC, and in Vancouver, the New York Theatre, the UBC Sub Ballroom, the Commodore Ballroom, and many other small venues. By 1990, I was listening to punk, hardcore, metal, funk, and rap, and I spent all my time skateboarding when I should have been studying for my then college courses. In fact, I was returning from college after being informed I had been put on academic suspension when a friend told me I looked like Kurt Cobain. I replied, "Who's that?" Months later, being freed from school, I was traveling back from Seattle listening to music that, unlike British punk, DC hardcore, or California beaches, Seattle sub pop captured a sound that reflected the loneliness of Vancouver's weather and the uncertainty of my own future. When I got back home, I had to ask myself, what is this?
Oh,
first song was from Seattle's Green River, arguably the first grunge band. Green River eventually split into Mudhoney and Mother Love Bone, which I played second. Popular early 1990s music was all about glam rock, which was campy and indulgent. Grunge, as Mark Rahm from Mudhoney called it, was inspired by heavy rock and punk, but was musically slower and more complicated. Grunge retained the same rebellious spirit as influential Seattle rock bands like the Sonics, Heart, and Metal Church, while reflecting the weather, economy, and mood of the Pacific Northwest. Much like Vancouver, Seattle was an isolated, small blue-collar city with a large university. Bars were playing hard rock and alternative music, and it was a natural progression that local bands would reflect this. The University of BC radio station CITR presented many grunge concerts in Vancouver.
Saturday, August 25th, CITR FM 101.9 presents an all-ages show at the New York Theater featuring Sonic Youth and Seattle's Nirvana. Saturday, August 25th at the New York Theater, presented by CITR.
Grant Lawrence, a Canadian broadcaster, musician, and writer, talks about booking shows.
We are recording.
All right.
So I'm here with Grant Lawrence.
Hi, Roger.
The famous Grant Lawrence.
So what you were asking about contacting the bands? Well, it was all by phone. And so what we would have to do, and it started really in the late 80s when Nardwar and I were tracking bands down to play our all-ages shows. We would go to great lengths. We would do amazing detective work tracking bands down. What we would do in the grunge era is we would try to figure out the phone numbers of these bands. And so Nardwar, he probably told you, got the phone number for, I think it was Steve Turner, from the clerk at Fallout Records, Janet, I think was her name, in Seattle.
Right, yeah.
Cool record store down there.
Yeah.
Nardwar managed to convince her to cough up this phone number. And it was always digits, just, you know, scribbled on a little scrap of paper. And for Nirvana, when I booked Nirvana at the Commodore, just as the whole Nevermind fervor was starting to build, I was friends with Susie Tennant, who was the Seattle representative for DGC Records,
okay,
which is who Nirvana signed with. And I begged her for Kurt Cobain's phone number.
Wow.
And she wouldn't give me Kurt's phone number, but she's like, okay, I'll give you Chris's phone number.
Because
they were kind of in between management, and they were kind of, you know, things, all their pieces were starting to be put into place for Nevermind. But I caught them at a kind of a moment of self-management and self. And so I called up Chris Novoselic, and I said, hey, you haven't played in Vancouver in a long time. Do you want to play? And at first we were trying to get them for an all-ages show with Nardwar, but we couldn't work it out, so I booked them at the Commodore Ballroom. And they wanted to play. They wanted to do a show with the Screaming Trees.
Right.
So it was going to be Nirvana and the Screaming Trees. And then another promoter across town had a show, The Doughboys and the Wongs, featuring members of SNFU.
Right.
And so I thought, I don't want to compete against the Doughboys. Now, the Doughboys were not grunge. They were kind of late 80s, you know, 80s punk, but they still had popularity, though they were feeling the grunge squeeze for sure.
Yeah.
So then I talked to the promoter, and I said, let's combine the show. So it was this huge show at the Commodore, Screaming Trees headlining, because they were bigger than Nirvana at the time. Then Nirvana, Then the Doughboys, who were furious, they thought they should have been headlining the whole thing, and then the Wong. And it was completely packed and sold out, and it was a couple of months before Nevermind. But the hype was building big time. And by the time the gig came, from the time we announced the gig to the time of the night of the gig, it was obvious that Nirvana should have been headlining.
Right.
They sold the tickets. But Screaming Trees were still the senior statesman, and Nirvana respected that. So that was all set up by the phone, all just a whole bunch of tons of phone calls.
Hi, I'm Howie Mandel, and I really like the music at Christmas time.
Record release party Tuesday, October 30th at the Commodore Ballroom featuring Tank Hog, Chris Houston's Evil Twang, She, and the Evaporators. Tickets are available at Track, Zulu, and Scratch Records, also at Ticketmaster. That's the Tank Hog record release party Tuesday, October 30th at the Commodore, presented by CITR.
Stephen Hamm from Vancouver's original grunge band Slow, and then later Tank Hog, tells a story about going to Seattle to play with Green River.
Slow wanted to go to Seattle in around 1985 to play a show because we knew that there was a pretty happening scene in Seattle. We knew that mostly because we had played with the Young Fresh Fellows up in Vancouver at the Commodore Ballroom. The first time I played the Commodore was the Zulu Review with the Enigmas, Gopher 3, and the Young Fresh Fellows. And we struck up a friendship with them, and they said, you should come to Seattle. And we're like, we would love to come to Seattle. You know, some of our favorite bands, like mostly the Fastbacks, were from Seattle, so we wanted to go down there. And so Jonathan Poman, who later went on to found Sub Pop Records, called us up, and he was booking bands. And he wanted us to come down and play at the Rainbow at the U District. And he had a band called Green River who he wanted to open for us. And we were like, this is great. We're going to go to Seattle. We wanted a Seattle show, but we were a little bit pissed off because we figured a band called Green River must be a CCR cover band because we had played with a few cover bands. This was 1985, and especially in Canada, you could get on some pretty ridiculous bills. So we're like, okay, we're gonna go do it anyhow. Who cares if we get a CCR cover band opening for us? So we got down there, and it was pretty great. We get there, and the thing is we go to the club, and we find out, of course, that Green River is not a CCR cover band. And there are all these cool bands happening in Seattle, like Soundgarden and the U-Men, the ones that really come to mind. What I remember about playing down there was we were 19, or Tom, anyhow, was 19. I believe I was 20. And so we were all underage. We couldn't actually get into the bars down there. But they had an arrangement where if you're underage, you could basically just come into the club long enough to play and then leave. So I remember Jim Sangster of the Young Fresh Fellows coming to see us, and he always tells me the story of he came to the Rainbow, and it was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, sound check time, and we're all sitting on the front stairs of the Rainbow drinking beer, and he was like, what the hell are you guys doing? And he's like, and we just said, like, well, we can't go inside because they won't let us inside, so we have to drink out on the front steps. Anyhow, the show was great. Green River, it was funny because I remember mostly meeting Jeff Ament, and mostly Jeff because he's a bass player, and I remember he was wearing like a green neon fishnet shirt, and the whole thing going on in Seattle at the time, there was Malfunction was another one of the big bands, who was Andy, who went on to be the lead singer of Mother Love Bone. You know, all those guys were super into glam. They were really, it was as much as it was grunge in 1985 in Seattle, it was kind of a New York Dolls-y glam thing going on. So, and we came down there, and I always sort of tell the story, and this is kind of a little bit made up, but, I mean, our moms used to dress us when we were in SLO, and mostly my mom bought me, you know, plaid shirts from Army and Navy, and so that's sort of the look that we went, you know, down there with, and DOA kind of had pioneered that look, the lumberjack look, back in the, you know, the late 70s. So we kind of say sometimes that SLO's moms invented grunge fashion, because soon after, all those guys, they went from the sort of a glam look to a more of the grunge look. And, you know, Green River were great. I remember the guys from Soundgarden were at the show. We were excited because we got to, you know, we met Kurt and Lulu from and Kim from the Fastbacks, and we actually stayed at Kim's place, and it was just a hoot. And then we decided to invite Green River up here to play with us, which ended up being SLO's last show at the Town Pump. And again, they were wicked. And you know, the band went on to split into Mudhoney, and of course Mother Love Bone, which then became Pearl Jam, and yeah, the rest is history.
Sub Pop Records captured and manufactured the sound of Seattle, branding it as grunge, and releasing records by pretty much all the bands associated with it. Vancouver had heavy metal producer Bob Rock, and Mint Records representing Vancouver, releasing records from bands like Cub, Hanson Brothers, Pluto, Tank Hog, and The Smugglers. Yet Mint never really had the same widespread success as Sub Pop.
Hey, are you doing anything important on the 3rd of May, which is a Friday night? Something important, cancel it, because Skin Yard are coming to the Cruel Elephant on the 3rd of May, which is a Friday night. They're also playing with two special guests, not one, but two. Cats Game from Vancouver, through Scare Nardwar, and Lester's Wagon, a band to watch out for. It's at the Cruel Elephant. This is the CITR 101.9 FM presentation.
Vancouver author and former 1990s promotion director at CITR, Aaron Chapman.
You know, when you think about what's happening with the grunge scene and maybe what happened, you know, in correlation from with everything, the Seattle explosion to what was happening here in Vancouver, it's interesting to think about, because in the decade prior to 1992, when, let's say, when grunge exploded, 91, 92, when you think about what was happening in Vancouver, in the late 70s, up until the mid to late 80s, there was a real wave of independent releases and bands putting out their own records, or putting out their own records on their own labels, or mom-and-pop record labels and whatnot. It was a real sort of golden time for independent music releases that way. Certainly in the case of 7-inches and cassettes and things like that, with DOA and the Pointed Sticks and the Modernettes. A litany of bands that all were putting out their own stuff. That tended to trail off in the late 80s, it seems, where bands, you know, that were maybe a going concern from SLO or the Scramblers or stuff like, or groups like that, or even bands that were just sort of starting out, there wasn't that idea to make your own 7-inches or make your own records or your own singles anymore. People were just making demos to hopefully get a record deal. Whereas across the border in Seattle with Sub Pop, they were still very active in putting out that recorded material. So maybe there was a primer coat with Sub Pop more than what was happening here with some of the record labels here. Even though there were, you know, certainly indie record labels like Zulu Records or Mint Records that came along a little bit later, I guess, that happened. you know, Sub Pop was really sort of ready to go, perhaps. And in many ways, perhaps because Seattle hadn't really been spotlighted in American culture, maybe the city was ready and that it was ready for its time. That way, perhaps, you know, had things had been a little different, Minneapolis or Atlanta or some other place would have happened, or if Vancouver would have still kept going with that trend of putting out so much independent recorded music as it had between 77 and 88, maybe it would have happened here.
Saturday, May 11th, CITR presents the world's heaviest band, the Melvins. At the Cruel Elephant, CITR presents the Kings of Grind, the Melvins, with special guests Drone and Sludge.
CITR presented many large grunge concerts at bars in Vancouver, TAD as well as Pearl Jam at the Town Pump, Sonic Youth with Nirvana at the New York Theatre, and at the Commodore, Nirvana with Mudhoney, The Screaming Trees with Nirvana, Soundgarden with Voivod, but UBC's Sub Ballroom was an unusual venue. I had been singing along to Mudhoney's Touch Me, I'm Sick for over a year when I read that they would be playing a rare all-ages show at the University of British Columbia. Little did I know it would become one of Vancouver's most notorious concerts. Here's Nardwuar to describe why.
It's Nardwuar, the human serviette in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, right outside the Student Union building at UBC's Sub Ballroom. In fact, in the background, you can hear some people using it for an activity right now, not an all-ages 1,000-person punk rock gig that we put on Saturday, November 10th. 1990. I was able to get Mudhoney because I went to Seattle, Washington, went into my favorite record store, Fallout Records, and the clerk there, Janet, gave me Steve Turner of Mudhoney's phone number. I phoned up Steve, and he agreed to play an all-ages gig in Vancouver. They could have played a bar gig and made a whole bunch of money, but they decided they wanted to do a gig for the kids, which was incredible. They brought Beat Happening up from Olympia, Washington to open, and we had two local bands play as well, The Smugglers and my own band, The Evaporators. CITR put on the gig, and it was only $6 to get into the concert. I had an idea, because I'd done other gigs as Nardwuar to Human Serviette Presents, to hand out pennies at the gig. Why? Because the next gig you come to, it's a Nardwuar gig, you get a nickel, and the next gig you come after that, you get a dime. In other words, you get rich by coming to Nardwuar to Human Serviette gigs. So I was handing out these pennies, 1980s, and I was talking to people about how this was the way things worked when it came to a Nardwuar gig up on stage, and nobody was listening to me. In frustration, people started throwing the pennies at me, and I said, okay, everybody spit on me. I got a cold, and so did my mom for the next 3 months. Now, why did people spit on me? Because it was a crazy audience, one that I hadn't encountered before. I'd put on gigs with, like, garage bands, like the Night Stalkers from Vancouver or the Gruesomes from Montreal, but never with a band like Mudhoney, who had a lot of hype around them. I never used the word grunge. I used garage punk. They were collaborating with Billy Childish. But people out there in the Vancouver musical community, they were like, oh my God, I love Led Zeppelin, and Led Zeppelin are playing at UBC. I'm like, what are you talking about? Mudhoney are sort of like Led Zeppelin. So you had a whole portion of a crowd that had never been to a Nardwuar to Human Serviette rock and roll gig like that. It was pretty wild. I think the girl who was in the movie The Wizard of Oz, Firouza Balk, was even on the stage. I know that because I videotaped a gig of all the people stage diving, and there she is in the corner. It was so fun for all the kids that were in attendance. And I just love the fact that CITR, me, and everybody else was able to pull this off from CITR. What an achievement. CITR Week at UBC. Nardwuar to Human Serviette presents Whoa Dad, It's Mudhoney. Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, Whoa Dad.
The grunge scene had many women contributors, just to name a few: Kim Martin of Sonic Youth, L7, Courtney Love, and Babes in Toyland, who, when playing with the Screaming Trees in Vancouver, played with such intensity it was said to be scary.
On January 28th, CITR is proud to present a Battle of the Sexes at the Town Pump. In one corner, the heavyweight champions of Ellensburg, Washington, four jangly icons of masculinity, weighing in at 1,200 pounds, the Screaming Trees. In the other corner, hailing from the 80s musical mecca of Minneapolis, Minnesota, and representing the fairer sex, three shining champions of femininity, Babes in Toyland. That's right, folks. January 28th, live at the Town Pump, Screaming Trees and Babes in Toyland. This event will not be broadcast on television. Doors open at 7:30, bell rings at 9 o'clock. Presented by CITR.
Vancouver had Cuddlecore founders Cub, the pop side to grunge. Lisa Marr, formerly of Cub, talks about playing with Hole.
Hello, my name is Lisa Marr, and I was a CITR DJ in the late 1980s and early 90s, as well as the editor of Discorder in the early 90s. I was a CITR member for many years while I was going to school at UBC, studying creative writing, and then also for many years after. CITR was my home and my family, and I love it. I was in a band called Cub from 1992 to 1997, and Cub actually formed largely because of CITR, because of the shows I was doing there, because of the music I was being exposed to there, and because of the friends that I met there. And one of the friends was Robin Iwata, who later became the guitar player in Cub. And of course, Bill and Randy, who are the founders of Mint Records. A bunch of us who worked at the radio station would always be going down to Seattle to see shows. And it was the time of grunge in the early 90s, of course. So we would go to Nirvana shows and Mudhoney shows and Screaming Trees shows and Tad shows and Melvin shows. And we loved it all. But we also loved all these really poppy bands that were coming out of the Pacific Northwest around that time, too. Bands like The Fastbacks and Girl Trouble, who we really loved. There was just so much music, and it was such an exciting time, and so many different kinds of shows. And you really could go to these shows in like tiny clubs or warehouses and parties where you'd see, you know, all kinds of music here, all kinds of music happening, and it was amazing. When Cub started playing a lot in 1992 and then 1993, we loved playing with all different kinds of bands too. And at one point in 1993, we did get invited to open for Hole at the Town Pump, featuring, of course, Courtney Love, who was already by then very notorious, and this sort of larger than life character who actually I was a little bit afraid of because she was just so loud and in your face and I guess maybe a little bit unpredictable. So I tended to be a bit more shy in a way, and not prone to like screaming at people at random moments. So I found her a bit intimidating actually. And I don't really remember having any sort of conversation with her. I remember seeing them sitting in their dressing room and being a little too intimidated to even go in and say hello. But I do remember it was a pretty amazing set that night by them, and it was packed. And later we heard that Patty Schemmel, the drummer, had been the one to request that we play with them. And she is an incredible drummer and was into supporting other female musicians, I think. Cub was an all-woman band. And I think that was sort of the appeal, and just that we were kind of this ragtag group of people figuring out what we were doing as we were going along. And there was a certain energy to that that I think she appreciated. We were also told later that Kurt Cobain had been a Cub fan. So maybe that was part of it, too, that he had heard the music and also liked, you know, just the freshness of it, and maybe they had sort of shared that, and maybe he had also been one of the people saying, hey, you should check out this band up there. Who knows? That's just conjecture and legend, obviously, at this point. But as far as 1991 being the year punk died, I don't know about that, but I do know that 1993 was the year that cuddlecore was born, and it's a genre that stuck with Cub, for better or worse, over the course of our five-year career. And now people are still, of course, talking about grunge, but they're also still talking about cuddlecore. And there's a whole new generation of fans that are hearing that music for the first time, thanks to their parents or the internet or finding old records in record stores, and are getting turned on to it and are starting bands of their own. And that is exciting to me. Thanks.
All right, and live from Thunderbird Radio Hell, we have a rock and roll band. Next week it's going to be Jumbo Cross, and in from Victoria Closet Man. And we just had some sitar music, right?
Right.
And we had Joey before that.
Right.
And you are?
Cub.
Okay, Cub, play the blue. Oh, you're live right now, aren't you?
I think so.
You're playing live.
Live.
Live from Thunderbird Radio Hell. Okay, Cub, play. Who's in Cub?
Robin's in Cub, and Valeria's in Cub, and Lisa's in Cub.
Okay, Cub, play the blues.
This song's called Chico. One, two, three, four. That's right, we're Cub. And before I forget to mention it, we're going to be playing at Zulu Records live in store on the 16th of October. So we hope to see you there. It's going to be at 4:30 p.m. And we're going to have records and t-shirts, and we'll be signing autographs for all you collectors out there. Okay, this one's called...
June 29th from Hollywood, California, Sub Pop recording artist Hull with guest Silkworm at the Cruel Elephant. Hull.
1992 edition of the Discorder, Mofo storms the Music West Conference. Courtney Love gets down and makes love. I suck your brain, you blow my head. Teenage Fan Club and Buffalo Tom are victims of music press hyperbole. Also the usual sections, Coral Shorts Vancouver Special, and Tara Sloan's Future Rap. And hey, we even review the new Lyle Lovett release, Joshua Judge's Root. So come on, pick up this month's June edition of The Discorder. It's free!
Fizz, fizz.
Valentine Premium. Premium ingredients, premium brewed.
Bosco gives me iron and sunshine vitamin D.
Oh, I love Bosco. That's the drink for me.
My dog's better than your dog.
Meow, 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 meow.
America's the greatest land of all.
You are listening to CITR 101.9. Commercial free, campus and community radio.
Oh, what a relief.
Let me know when we're in orbit.
Approaching right on the dot, just as they plotted it, Brother Severn.
What will that do to them? What is it?
Well, I'm using sound against them.
One, two, three, four.
One.
Meet Daisy.
Two.
Blaise Pascal.
Three.
Crayon.
Four.
Cub.
Okay, just to recap all that, four bands. That's right. One, two, three, four. I wish you were starting your own song. Come down 24th of February.
Cruel Elephant.
The four bands, once again, were...
Meet Daisy.
Cub.
Blaise Pascal.
And Crayon from Bellingham. On Harriet Records. See you there.
By 1993, grunge was the music for the masses. Alice in Chains' record went gold, then Nirvana, then Pearl Jam. Marc Jacobs was having grunge fashion shows, and any kid could buy the Mac jacket uniform at the mall. Grunge was being marketed to everybody for everything. Joe Keithley of DOA gives his take on the look.
Like the lumberjack Vancouver look ends up in malls.
Yeah, that was disappointing. I never really thought about it too much because we kind of took it, this is like the Mac jackets people would wear like when they're working construction or working on the an outdoor type job, and we kind of identified that if it was a red Mac jacket, you were from East Van or Burnaby. If it was a green Mac jacket, you were from North Van. And if it was a purple Mac jacket, you were from Surrey. It was a bit of a color code type thing. And I didn't think about it too much, but then Doug Donut, he used to play in the band with Pete Cleaver, the Sentence, right. Doug, he's still around the scene, stuff like that, but Doug from the Death Sentence, he says, Joe, you know what? All those guys are wearing Mac jackets and, these type of check shirts because they saw DOA in the early days. And because we were always, Dave and I and Brian, from 82 to about 88, 89, we're always wearing these things. And we're like wearing them in the Taking Care of Business video. So he attributed the look completely to DOA, that these guys had ripped off the DOA look. On the other hand, I think if you look at it, it was a very utilitarian thing to wear and keep warm in a wet, soggy place like Seattle, which is just like Vancouver. So right. You can look at it both ways.
All right. Now here's something you don't want to miss. CITR presents on Valentine's Day, February the 14th, at 86th Street Music Hall. For the first time ever, together, DOA and Bolero Lava. Now, let me tell you geeks that if you miss this, you truly are a pencil neck. DOA are ready to crush your futile brain into the dust, and Bolero Lava will do something similar, I'm sure. Okay, so that's February 14th at 86th Street Music Hall. That's Valentine's Day, in case you've been living under a rock there, pal.
Y'all say you're sitting around February 14th, Valentine's Day, with nothing to do. Come on down to 86th Street Music Hall and see DOA back in town again. DOA, February 14th at 86th Street Music Hall. Should be a great show. St. Valentine's Day Massacre. Tickets available at the usual places. That's DOA, February 14th. 86th Street Music Hall. Say hey, say DOA, hey! Presented by CITR FM 102.
It didn't take long for the bands given the grunge label to resent the genre and feel uncomfortable with their commercial success. Sonic Youth had done a stadium tour with Neil Young, Nirvana had appeared on Saturday Night Live, Pearl Jam were on the cover of Time magazine, and movies were being written about Seattle's music scene. The bands that created the genre had distanced themselves from it. But not all bands labeled as grunge were enjoying such widespread success. Grant Lawrence talks about Sub Pop's Love Battery.
Hey, this sounds cool. What is it? Oh, it's Love Battery. And they're coming to the Cruel Elephant on January 18th. Wow, this is cool. I'm gonna go.
Does this sound cool to you? Well, this is Three Chicks and Two Dicks, otherwise known as Sybil. Also playing with Love Battery on the 18th of January is a bunch of ex-Derelict members who are now Zip Gun. This is at the Cruel Elephant on the 18th of January. Tickets can be had at all the usual locations. This is presented by CITR.
Wow, cool.
Wow, cool.
You know, almost every band was, if they came from Seattle and they were on Sub Pop, they were hot, like red, red, red hot. And when I was a young promoter at the time in Vancouver, any band, Tad, Nirvana, Mudhoney, all these bands were just like screaming trees. They were just instant sellouts. It was a promoter's dream. And Love Battery were for whatever reason, the ugly ducklings of the grunge scene. They're, you know, maybe their music wasn't aggressive enough. There was a little bit of elements of pop in their music, and maybe it just didn't hit hard enough. And for whatever reason, Love Battery just didn't click with the major with the fans. Right. And so, as a young promoter in Vancouver in the height of the grunge era, the 90-91 era, what I would the promoters would essentially, or not the promoters, sorry, I was the promoter. The agents would essentially bully me into, like if I wanted Tad at the, on Saturday night at the Town Pump, right, which was an instant sellout, 400 or 500 people, how many we could stuff in there, the agent would say, I'll give you Tad, but you have to take Love Battery 2 weeks later. And I'd be like, well, I knew Love Battery weren't that popular. And even worse, it was a Sunday night. Right. And Sunday nights are, it doesn't matter really who it is, Sunday nights are a very, very tough sell. It's the worst night of the week for rock and roll. It's even worse than Monday. Sunday is recovery day. Monday, people are already up and ready to go again. So, but I wanted this Tad show. So I took the Love Battery show on, and you know, a promoter kind of knows when a show is tanking. Number one, you check your pre-sold tickets. And leading up to the Love Battery gig, I remember I had announced it about a month previous, and after about 2 weeks, there was not a single ticket sold. That's a really bad sign.
Right.
A week in advance of the gig, not a single ticket sold. Now, I wanted to pull out of the gig and cancel it. But the promoter said, no, you have to stick with it. And the guarantee was something outrageous, like $1,000 US or something like that. Totally not what they were worth. But there was another act, I think it was Bad Religion or something like that, that was coming up after. And he said, if you cancel on Love Battery, you can't have Bad Religion or Coffin Break or whoever the band was. So I'm like, all right, I'll do this Love Battery gig. So days leading up, not a single ticket sold. So the night of the gig, Sunday night, I'm at home having Sunday dinner with my family, and I know I have to go down there because I'm the promoter, and I don't want to go alone. So I call Nardwar, and I say, Nardwar, please come to this Love Battery gig with me. It's looking so bad. And Nardwar's like, you know, fuck you. I'm not leaving my house. It's Sunday night. I think it was December or something like that. I'm not going down there. I'm like, please, you have to come. And we fought on the phone. And he finally said, okay, fine. And we made some deal like I'd take him to the McDonald's drive-thru. I'd buy him a Sunday. I'd buy him a Big Mac, whatever. So we went to the gig. And again, my stomach was in knots. Pull up to the Cruel Elephant, which was at Granville and Davie, and there's nobody in front. Another really bad sign. Like, there's just no traffic. We go in, and there's the bouncer who worked there for years and years. I can't remember his name, but he looked up and knew I was the promoter and just kind of shook his head. And we looked in, and there was not one single person in the club. Not one single person except for me and Nardwar, the bartender, and the bouncer. Not even Paul Mose, who owned the place, showed up because it was Sunday. And I thought, well, there's no way this gig's going to happen. And Love Battery played anyway to me and Nardwar and the bartender and the bouncer. And it was one of the most depressing nights of my life in rock and roll. It kind of drove me out of promoting in many ways. And I couldn't get the $1,000, $1,000 US.
Right, yeah.
So I was working at a concert production company at the time called Teamworks. Frank Weipert, still active right now. And I called him up Sunday night at like, you know, 11 midnight, whatever. I said, Frank, I'm in a bad spot. He came down in like his house coat with $1,000 US. I don't know where he got it from, in cash. Gave it to this band, Love Battery. And he fired me a couple days later. And that was pretty much it for me and concert promotion. I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy.
By 1993, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, and Alice in Chains had all signed with major record labels. The Seattle scene was a global phenomenon, and fragile Kurt Cobain was an unlikely spokesman for a generation of troubled youth. The grunge music wave had crashed. Vancouver's young youth spoofed the grunge sound and turned it up to 10 with up to 11 distorted guitars on stage at once. Stephen Hamm, who played in Slow, Tank Hog, and Young Youth.
Young Youth. I did play in Young Youth. We played one show opening up for the Muffs at the original Cruel Elephant, and that would have been sometime in the mid-90s. It was largely improvisational. We played because we were looking for a way to get free beer, and for some reason, Paul Mose of the one of the owners of the Cruel Elephant decided he would give us unlimited beer to play. We were all quite inebriated before the show started, and Paul decided to give us only light beer. The show was a mess, and the only thing is that was, you know, the mid-90s, so that was 30 years ago. Is that 30 years ago? Yeah, something like that. And 20 years ago, anyhow, 95, two, yeah. Every time I run into Ronnie from the Muffs, though, he remembers that I was a member of Young Youth. And I guess he remembers the show. I don't remember the show personally.
Grunge music continued on after Kurt Cobain's suicide, but it had lost the original spirit and eventually was referred to as grunge light. And also a new style of music called Britpop was taking over the airwaves. To end, Nardwar talks to Sonic Youth and Nirvana play at the Commodore March 8, 1991. Thank you, CITR.
What day is it today?
The 17th.
Of?
April.
19...
83.
1991, and first of all, who are you?
Sonic fucking Youth.
Sonic Youth, the rock band Sonic Youth.
Do you know Joey Shithead?
Joey Shithead from the rock and roll group DOA, a local legend, along with a lot of other legends.
Benefit for him once.
This is some early history of Sonic Youth.
We did a benefit for the bass player in the Subhumans.
Brian Goebel.
Yeah,
No, sorry, that was Jerry Hanna.
Jerry Useless, I think his name
Jerry
was.
Useless, yeah. And that was part of Squad. When was that, and where was that?
That was about 83. 82 or 83. It was when, you know, the Vancouver Five.
Uh-huh. Was that in Vancouver? Was that in Vancouver that benefit happened?
No, that was in a little town called Five.
A little town called Five?
Yeah.
Where is Five?
It's right next to Six.